There's a lot of stuff that we make that's unnecessary. It's not needed. We don't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily make our lives a whole lot better, right?
Who determines that? Even if you have the most Bernie Sanders, Jesus Christ-esque figure in office in the United States, no politician would voluntarily cap the growth potential of their country in order to benefit the planet.
When you cap growth, I mean, again, you've changed the game theory, like a very fundamental game theory dynamic. Would that not lead to less cooperation, less trade, more war?
The pie as we see it doesn't necessarily need to shrink, right? We might be shrinking in terms of money or wealth, for example, or in terms of how much gets produced. But what if the pie wasn't measured in terms of how much crap gets produced and how much wealth there is? What if the pie was about how happy people were? What if the pie was about if their needs were met and if they had community?
Welcome to Radius of Reason. I'm Levon here with my co-host, Andre.
On the show, we often talk about how unchecked economic growth is destroying the planet. In search of a better system, we're joined today by JP Arellano, an activist and co-founder of the International Degrowth Network. This is a movement to scale back unchecked consumption-based capitalism.
We talk about if unbridled growth is unique to capitalism or just a symptom of human nature. If the global north can function without exploiting the global south. And if degrowth is feasible given the current state of geopolitics. JP, why is global society obsessed with growth?
Okay, so I've actually got quite a story for y'all, because it is a story, and we haven't always been this way. And I think it's a really important question to ask, because at the moment, at least in current days, it's not even questioned, right? Perpetual economic growth is our savior, be all, end all, hallelujah, fixes all of our problems. And we never question where it actually came from. And it came from somewhere, right? We weren't always... The Mesopotamians weren't obsessed with economic growth, neither were the Greeks or the Romans. And it's actually way, way more recent than you'd think so. So as recent as World War II. Before World War II, there actually wasn't really a grow or die politics, right? And the precursor to GDP was called the National Income Accounts. And these were assembled around the 1930s. Made to measure output, particularly related to accounting for the machinery, arms, and weapons being manufactured for World War II. And this was developed by this guy called Kuznets. And there's this famous quote of him warning Congress in 1934, saying that the, yeah, we got plenty of these quotes warning Congress that they absolutely ignore. in posterity, but essentially telling them the welfare of a nation can scarcely be inferred from a measure of national income, right? But then since then, the metric has become the yardstick anyways to measure the prosperity of a nation. And so with this, you know, full-on war planning mode, it really showed how states could really steer production and jobs at scale. And the need to measure this, and not only measure, but compare, right, to other countries. And then after 1945, after the war was over, when the Bretton Woods institutions were built, the IMF and the World Bank, these were explicitly created to foster this reconstruction, right, of Europe and other parts of the world with the key of long-term growth, right, under this stable monetary order. And so growth, the growth of your national production and consumption, it really became the only way to secure employment, tax revenues, and financing or loans, and in the end, geopolitical clout, right? Later on, around the 60s, I want to say 61, the OECD, the newly made OECD, created its first ministerial set. Creating growth essentially as a policy commandment, right? Ensuring that these nations had a target to combine, to raise combined GDP by 50% by 1970. Officials later on essentially called the OECD a temple of growth, where growth became a cross-party, technocratic, essentially common sense, right, that really crowded out a lot of the other goals that had been set out before. And this is where it gets really interesting, right? It essentially became a tool against class struggle. And this is really where the propaganda and the creation of this common sense came about, right? So with the rising wave of neoliberalism, increasing inequality, privatizing services, deregulations, the state and corporations essentially needed an extremely strong common sense or propaganda tool or campaign to satisfy the masses, right? And so rather than redistributing assets or democratizing firms or taxing the wealthy, etc., rich countries promised rising wages by a rising GDP, right? Or I'm sure we've all heard, a rising tide lifts all boats. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the rest is history, right? After the 1970s stagflation and then the full-on financialization of our planet and of our economies, they really went full throttle. And this obsession with shareholder value pressures and short-termism cemented, really, this corporate grow-or-die mentality and treadmill that we've been unable to get off of sense. And now it's illegal, right? I mean, the number one responsibility of a CEO is to increase shareholder value, right? And how do you do that? But by growing and growing and growing and selling more crap that people probably don't need. And so now we judge politics is really just judged on quarterly growth, right? Regardless of party, country, ideology. And it's not a law of nature. It was made up, right? It was created and fairly recently. And better yet, it's an idea. It's a dogma. Essentially, it is a dogma that we blindly follow, and it's supported by extremely embedded institutional design. And that's kind of what's led up to where we are today.
You know, let's zoom in on the 1970s, because I think it was a very important period, right, with the advent of neoliberal policies and the exportation, right, of this paradigm. Why... You mentioned the Great Stagnation, right? Tell us how exporting this idea to all these various nations in the global South was, like, how all those dynamics played together, right? Because you have to, when you stop growing at a certain rate at home, you kind of have to look elsewhere. So maybe kind of going to that a little bit.
Yeah.
Like, this was not an accident, right? Like, this, they didn't just, yeah.
Essentially, something I've come to learn is that capitalism is guided by a logic, right? Of you need to take more from nature and labor than you give back. That's the only way capitalism works, because we need to create surplus value, right? To reinvest and create more and more and more. And the only way to create surplus value is by taking more from nature and labor than you can give back. And this has... and I promise it's relevant. This has really fundamental consequences, right? How do you take more than you give back, right? You cheapen wages, right? You lengthen work days. You deregulate workplaces. You deregulate nature or remove safety standards or cleanup standards, environmental standards, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Essentially, you create worse conditions for your domestic population. And at some point, your domestic population can only take this to a certain amount, right? At some point there will be a revolt, a revolution, or mass strike, or upheaval, etc. And so what these very smart white imperialist capitalists did in the North...
How dare you? How dare you bring raisin?
Hey, everybody. Hope you're enjoying this conversation with JP. Just a reminder, if you want to support our channel, please give this video a like. And if you're not yet subscribed, please do so.
And of course, drop us a comment. Let us know what you think about degrowth.
They realized this limit, and they realized the need for the export. But this was before the 70s, eh? This is kind of with the advent of imperialism and colonialism. But they realized that the need to export this cheapening of labor and resources. They realized that that's why they needed colonies. They realized that it was much easier to subjugate an external or foreign population towards this more degrading and lower quality of life, to cheapen their labor, to cheapen inputs, right? The more desperate you make somebody, right, the more you remove access to food, to water, to sanitation, to hygiene, to education, et cetera, the more willing they work, the more willing they are to work for a cheaper price, right? And so this is essentially how the West underdeveloped much of the global South. And so back to the 70s, right, during this whole period of anti-colonialism, with many nations in Africa gaining independence for the first time, and the West having had lost their colonies in the Americas and Asia earlier on, they needed to create a system that continued to allow them to cheapen these inputs, but wasn't so overt as colonialism, right? Those my colonies, et cetera. So that's what a lot of the Bretton Woods institutions did. They institutionalized and normalized, or better yet, invisibilized this colonialism, right? And that's why we call it neo-colonialism, where the loans that they would provide to these developing nations came with a lot of strings attached, right? The IMF calls them structural adjustment programs. Really what they were was like a free-for-all for private corporate greed. Liberalizing their economies, defunding public sectors like healthcare, education, setting extraordinarily high growth targets, and essentially giving free rein to foreign corporations, right? Deregulation, denationalization, opening up giant swaths of land for extraction, for resources, etc. And this has led to many of these nations prioritizing this corporate extraction of wealth, resources, labor, land, water, etc., instead of focusing on their national development objectives, right? Like literacy rates, life expectation, mean years of schooling, access to doctors, etc. And this is what's led to what we call now unequal exchange or ecological unequal exchange, where it's the sum of all the trade from the north to the south that when taken in aggregate, it clearly shows visibly this massive, massive drain from the south to the north of underpaid resources, labor, land. And this is, and the total is insane. It's valued at around $10 to $11 trillion a year in northern prices from 1990 to 2015.
And right? Unless you ask the administration of Donald Trump, who would argue that all these countries, Swaziland, Lesotho, are all taking away from the US economy. fair. I think all of that is a very valid argument. There I think when it's laid out before you, it's hard not to acknowledge the fact that the growth, the explosive growth of, let's call it the global north, but, you know, for our respective audiences, North America, Europe, and whatnot, was that kind of growth was contingent on the economic subjugation of other regions, very much continuing some of the colonial legacies of the British Empire and Spanish Empire and whatnot. But sure. However, there's also this cognitive dissonance that comes into play, because without question, the three of us have benefited from this arrangement. We've been able to live a certain quality of life. We've been able to travel. We've been able to sit with fancy computers and recording equipment and spew our nonsense onto the internet. How do we reconcile our status with the fact that it's built upon these very unfair and, I'd say, quite destructive circumstances for the rest of the planet?
Yeah, I think that touches upon a really, really important point. And I want to, just touching upon the first bit you said, just to reemphasize, this $10, $11 trillion a year, about $250 trillion from 1990 to 2015, is about a quarter of northern GDP, right? So very, very much it's necessary for the growth of northern economies. But yes, right. You're right. So no one is saying that capitalism hasn't brought, or growth, right, or whatever, hasn't brought some good to the planet, right? You can always argue for and against it, right? Who invented GPS or the internet or et cetera, you know, the public sector, the military, or even smartphones, right? Not necessarily private innovation, right? Anyway, I'm not going to get into this whole who is actually responsible for innovation. But hint, hint, you can look at China. To your note, yes. So the global North working class, particularly the upper classes, have massively benefited from this colonial extraction, from this colonial and imperial dynamic, power dynamic that is unjust and unequal. How do we reconcile with this? Well, I think it's important to note that the main issue is not primarily the global North working class. It is really the richest of the rich that have unfathomably benefited from the system. Like, yes, you and I have, but the richest of the rich have unfathomably benefited from the system, right? I mean, I don't have the exact quote fact off the top of my head, but somewhere along the 10 richest Americans own 50% of the wealth in the United States.
Yeah.
The four largest corporations in the S&P 500 are what, 40%, 50%, or 70% of the entire stock market? That's insane. That's an insane concentration of wealth into the hands of very, very, very few people. And so when we look at this globally, it's actually quite interesting, because we've been fed this lie that there's not enough, right? That there's not enough for this quality of life for everybody. But recent studies have actually showed that we can give decent standards of living, and they define what decent standards of living are, right? That's access to dignified housing, that's access to electricity, hygiene services, free education, free healthcare, electric public transit, a dishwasher at home, Wi-Fi, etc., right? This is totally doable for the entire population of the of planet Earth, of humans, using significantly less resources and significantly less energy than we do now. By significantly, I mean more, less than 50% of what we use now. So imagine halving our current environmental impact through energy and material use, and providing the entire world access to a decent standard of living, right? And this, I'm talking about this when we live in a place where there's this entire accumulation of wealth, yet there's still 700 million people without access to electricity, right? One in five children in the United Kingdom are hungry, right? In the United States, there are about 800,000 people without a home, right? When there's more homes that are vacant and not used, et cetera. So I see this a lot more as a redistribution problem that's been normalized, that those who work very hard, they deserve everything that they've gotten. And everyone else who doesn't have that hasn't worked hard enough or was just unlucky. And that's just the game, the way the game of life works. But I think this is a narrative that we need to contradict, that it really is a massive redistribution problem rather than a only some can have it this good.
And maybe further substantiate that with the ecological impact. That's, I mean, you kind of have alluded to that already. Maybe just really like set that tone for us. Like, what has been the ecological impact from, I mean, we know about climate change, but like what, maybe give us some numbers, give us some idea of like what's actually going on as a result of all this economic growth, which is obviously very much tied to the physical resources and pollution, et cetera.
Are you sure you want to know? I have.
We may have talked about it a few times on this podcast.
It's a recurring theme, but yeah, cook.
So it's bad, right? It's bad. It's not good. Okay. In short, we're approaching very, very, very dangerous territory, right? We're busting past planetary limits, right? There's these planetary boundaries that we have. These quantified, I don't know if in the recording you can put up this little graph of the planetary boundaries, but there's these limits of the planet, these physical limits that have been quantified, most of them. And essentially, these limits are necessary for the reproduction of life, not just human life, but ecosystems, marines, deserts, etc. And for example, one like climate change or biodiversity loss or land use change or nitrogen and phosphorus use, for example, or ozone depletion. These big, big, big topic things that if crossed too far and for too long, make the conditions that are necessary for the regeneration of life unviable. And so how many do you think we've crossed out of these nine planetary boundaries so far?
Probably like seven.
Yeah, I'd say seven.
We're at 6 to 7 of these
Yeah.
planetary numbers that have been crossed, right? And this is massive. These are literally physical limits that we cannot change, that are necessary for the reproduction of life on Earth. Another extraordinarily sad moment happened just a couple of weeks ago, or a month or two ago, that coral reefs all around the world, warm water corals, have been declared to be pushed past their tipping point, i.e., no more corals. In about 100 years, we're going to lose all warm water corals that we have on planet Earth. And this is irreversible. They're gone. There's nothing that we can do to bring the corals back. For example, I don't know if y'all have ever seen a coral reef. The amount of life that is in them, the fish, the octopus, the squids, the snails, the sponges, whatever, those are vital food sources for 400 million people that depend on coastal fishing. Around the world, right? What's going to happen to 400 million people? That's an entire US and a bit of people dependent on a food source that's going to be irreversibly gone, right? I mean, just last year, global fossil fuel CO2 hit another record in 2024 and 2025, right? For SUVs alone would be the world's fifth largest emitter if they were a country, right? About 1 gigaton of CO2 per year. And this brings, we all know the Paris limit, right? That we want to keep temperatures below 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2 degrees Celsius, et cetera. And this requires
Yeah.
deep, rapid, sustained reductions, right? In this decade, like today. I mean, just last year or 2023.
I think we've already blown past it. I don't think because it's like a what like a 10-year moving average or something is how they actually measure, but like we've realistically it's like goodbye to that. I think a lot of people are estimating 3 to 4 degrees by the end of the century. Some even 3 degrees, 2.5 degrees by 2050, which is, it's just like our brain again. Our brains are very bad at like exponentials, but like,
It's bad.
it's gonna be exponentially worse, right? The difference between 1.5 degrees, the difference between like 1 degree going to 1.5 degrees and 1.5 going to 2 is not the same, right? It is
It's different from
exponentially worse.
like 30% species extinction loss to like 70 to 90% species extinction loss.
But
It's
is all of this something unique to the neoliberal economic system? I mean, if you look like back when we had, I guess, some foil to the current economic model, like the Soviet Union was also polluting the shit out of lakes. They contributed to, and this is, I'm playing devil's advocate. Like, I'm not like genuinely opposed to things you're saying, but Soviet Union, the RLC in Central Asia was completely like dried out through Soviet industrial policy. They constructed massive industrial projects. They clearly contributed to the environmental degradation of the planet. You referenced China. Of course, China probably is far more similar to some of the economic structures of the global north, but they're still, let's call them like an economic alternative to the world, still polluting the shit out of their environment. You have, waterbeds outside of Foxconn factories that turn purple because of all the rare earth metals that are being pumped into them. So this isn't anything unique to the economic system that's present in the United States or some of the other European economies, for instance. So
In
is it just
some,
a, go ahead.
sorry, no, you can finish off if
No,
you want.
I'm done.
In some ways, yes, and in some ways, no. So the examples you cite all depend on growth, right? So sometimes you can say, irrespective of what ideology is driving it, right? Relentless and unregulated economic growth will undoubtedly have ecological consequences. I mean, what does it mean to grow? It means to produce more, right? To produce and consume more. What does it mean to produce and consume more? It means to use more materials and more energy. What does it mean to use more materials and more energy? It means extraction. And this extraction has negative ecological consequences,
So I
right?
think that's what I was getting at precisely. Is that so? Growth is the problem, but growth seems to be a state of nature within, like intrinsic to human, right? Where we
No, life
have,
itself, it's not just human, right? Like,
right.
I mean, it's fundamentally what is life? It's like just trying to extract energy from the
Right.
outside and like use it
But
for your
I,
own
but
good.
I, but I.
Down to the mitochondria on like a cellular
Right.
level, right? But so it's can we agree that it is a facet of the human condition that we have to grow? And it's kind of our maybe biological impulse to continue to grow.
It isn't. It isn't. Absolutely not. Can you think of any other species on the planet that is allowed to grow limitlessly?
We're the only ones that like came out of the trees and, you know, sprouted ants.
So this, like, for everything is limited. For example, you have, you can see the cycles of hares and foxes population, right? For example, you have rabbits that are the food source for foxes, and you have foxes that eat the rabbits, etc. rabbits explode in population, and thus more foxes can eat them. So foxes then explode, and then rabbits go down because there's more foxes. But then there's less food for the foxes, so they go down in population. Less predators, more rabbits, more predators, da da da, and it goes up and down, up and down. It's the same with almost any other organism, right? There's a limit. There's a physical ecological limit to how much they can actually physically grow in terms of population or in terms of size, etc. The only example that I can think of that's unbridled growth and that's unwanted growth, cancer, right? Cancer is one of the only organisms that is relentlessly growing without limits until it kills its host. So at the end of the day, it has a limit, right?
Are you equating humanity to cancer? Are we a cancer on this planet?
I think some could make the argument for that. I'd like to be a little bit more optimistic and a little bit more sympathetic to the human condition. I think we're a beautiful, wonderful miracle that's happened on this earth. And I think we have potential to do a lot of good. But this growth...
But yeah, currently we're a cancer, yes.
But the growth obsession, and like I said, I don't think it's natural, and it's not something that's always happened throughout history. It's recent, this obsession with growth, right? We don't need to have ever-growing economies, particularly when that growth is economic growth and not the growth of well-being, the growth of happiness, the growth of mental health, the growth of literacy rates, the growth of how intelligent and educated we are, etc. And I wanted to make a quick point on this, the ecological breakdown that we were talking about, because it really is... It's baked into this profit-seeking motive. And so whilst, yes, growth, regardless of ideology, in terms of production and consumption, can be harmful to the environment, it really has been exacerbated and pushed fully with capitalist neoliberalism. This obsession that we need to extract rent and profits has created an economy where it's the only logic that drives production and consumption, right? And this leads, like I had mentioned earlier, right, to worsening social conditions, so worsening material conditions for individuals and worsening ecological harm. And if we were able to transition to a society that didn't have this obsession on economic growth, we could be doing a lot better and still be having a lot of the things that we have now. And the tricky part with the current economic model is this thing that we call decoupling, right? Or green growth, where green growth says that we can continue to grow our economies as long as we are reducing emissions or reducing material impact fast enough. So this is what we call decoupling, where economic growth happens, yet emissions can go down. And there's different levels. There's absolute decoupling, which is GDP rises, emissions fall. There's relative decoupling, which is GDP rises, but emissions rise, but not as fast as GDP, for example. And absolute decoupling is possible. There's a lot of countries that have a rising GDP, yet are reducing their emissions, sometimes reducing material use, sometimes reducing water use, etc. And so this is what green growth, this is what capitalist or liberal green growth is promising us.
Can you get a little bit more specific on some of the economies that are doing this, like examples of countries that have successfully?
Yeah, Mexico, the United States, Sweden, Norway, France, Germany, Estonia, Chile, I want to say maybe even Turkey, etc. Quite a few nations that have GDP that's increasing and emissions that are either increasing slower or decreasing, for example. So it's very possible. The important point is the rate at which this is happening, right? The IPCC tells us that to stay within a livable Earth, we need to, like, deep, rapid, sustained reductions, like 7% of emissions per year. This is not
so
happening.
Have emissions decreased because... So the way I'd seen the U.S. the case for emissions decreasing is because industrial production has been re-exported out to other countries. So it's not that the emissions decreased, they just reallocated those emissions to smaller markets, right?
Yeah, like, some make that argument, but you can also measure these emissions based on consumption. So it also includes what you import into the country.
Gotcha.
And this will have been decreasing. And I think the main reason for this is because of the increased electrification of our societies, as well as the increase of use of renewable sources of energy, as well as less polluting sources of fossil energy, right? Using more natural gas than coal, or in the case of China, for example, their coal factories are extraordinarily efficient, like orders of magnitude more clean than a coal factory, for example, in a coal power plant in the United States, for example. So shifting to lower polluting sources of energy has allowed nations to reduce emissions overall and continue to grow their GDP. However, my argument, and the argument of quite a few degrowthers, is that this isn't happening fast enough, and that we cannot decouple fast enough. So a recent paper that came out said that high-income countries would take around 200 years to decarbonize their societies fully at current rates. You mentioned 10 years before, Vaughn. Doesn't sound like we have 200 years for these societies to fully decarbonize, right?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, to go back to the discussion you and Andre were having earlier about, you know, what is special about the growth that we're seeing more recently, given the economic kind of paradigm that we're in? Well, it's the rate of growth that is demanded that is the problem, right? Like, yes, like, we're going to grow, unless you're for, like, killing a ton of people and, like, limiting the population, like, artificially. Like, humans are kind of going to grow naturally, and we have to figure out a way to live on this planet with some amount of growth that a species might normally have. But when the economic incentives demand that there's a certain amount of growth and it's exponentially increasing, right, 2-3% a year globally, I mean, it's an exponential curve. So you have to satisfy that for the economic system to not collapse now, because if it collapses, then you have, you know, potentially billions of people dying, right? So you're handicapping yourself, because now we're up against these ecological limits and we have only so much time to address them, but we have to continue growing while we try to address them, which is obviously counter to that goal of trying to live within the ecological limits. But yeah, I think it's really important to make that distinction where it's not just growth. It's the paradigm itself demands a level of growth that simply may not, a frequency of growth, an acceleration of growth that may not give us enough time to properly adapt, right? Like, humans are very ingenious, right? We can innovate, and we might be able to, like, given enough time, we might actually be able to innovate our way out of these things. But that might be 200 years. That might be 500 years. That might be 2,000 years. We don't have that time. And I think that's an important qualification that often gets missed in these arguments. They're like, oh, humans will just innovate our way out of, you know, whatever, growth. We'll grow our way out of the problem, right?
I think there's also at times I struggle with the idea of degrowth also turning into just another wave of neocolonialism, where the select few countries that have enjoyed the fruits of global economic activity, that have benefited the most, that have produced, for lack of a better word, like a middle class that's able to live a certain quality of life, embrace full, like, white collar finance capitalism, and then all of a sudden those same countries turn on an axis and say, actually we need to start reducing growth, and again limit, like, we've enjoyed all of these benefits of the exploitative economic system, the global south has been struggling, and then it's like, yeah, well, instead of getting your place in the sun, now you got to start abiding by these more restrictive, like, growth parameters or whatnot. There's like a level of irony to it at times, I think. Mm-hmm. If you take away the existential doom that hovers over limitless growth and the prescriptions for that.
And I think you both make good points. Right now, we do depend on this on growth. Without economic growth, we fall into a crisis. We depend on this. Our economies need it at the moment because of how these institutions have been designed to revolve around this dogma. At the same time, Andre, I want to touch upon, because we haven't exactly defined degrowth just yet.
Yeah. Yes.
So maybe just briefly, degrowth entails the reduction, and this is like a very just like simple academic like definition, right? But the reduction of consumption and production in high-income nations with the aim of increasing equality, well-being for all, not just humans, and in the spirit of justice, right? Taking into account historical and ideological wrongs that have taken in this space. And so with that definition, and I mentioned high-income countries on purpose because of what you mentioned, right? And I think that's one of the main misconceptions that degrowth gets, that we want to reduce everything. Less cars, less hospitals, less schools, less roads, less fast food, less but and everybody, not just the rich countries, but the poor countries too, less and less, et cetera. Whereas many of these countries have been deprived of the necessary resources and wealth to achieve their national development objectives, right? As we mentioned, there are 700 million people that still don't have access to electricity. The point is that degrowth is specifically targeted against harmful industries. And wealthier individuals, those who have crossed or used more than their fair share of what's around, right? So if we think of the whole world as a big cake, et cetera, there are people who have had way more than they should have eaten of this cake. And there's folks that have had one crumb, maybe even less, right? And so degrowth actually is in favor of redistributing a lot of this wealth such that nations that have been historically subjected to colonialist and imperialist dynamics that have been systematically underdeveloped can have more wealth available for them to increase, to pursue their national development objectives, to redirect productive capacity to what's meaningful in their economies, and in their nations, whether it's healthcare, public transit, education, etc. And so in the North, in these rich countries, it really is about downscaling harmful and unnecessary forms of production. So there's a lot of stuff that we make that's unnecessary. It's not needed. We don't necessarily, it doesn't necessarily make our lives a whole lot better, right?
Who determines that? Who determines what is not necessary for?
Super fair question. Super fair question. And I think I'm just going to give you a couple of examples that are pretty basic, pretty simple, right? SUVs, private jets, giant yachts,
Okay, fair
cruise
point.
ships, right? Fossil fuels, industrial meat, fast fashion, et cetera, right? These are things that I think most of us can agree that they aren't really necessary. You can get around in a little car just as well as you could in a pickup truck. And I can assure you that the overwhelming majority of Americans who have a pickup truck aren't driving around carrying plywood and giant barrels of whatever, cement and things, just because it looks cool and it's what we've been
I
so.
mean, the Midwest is still the Midwest. Let's not totally discount plywood. It's
No, I'm saying the majority, right? And you can also have much smaller trucks that are also, for example, electrified that can pull around whatever you might need to pull around. It doesn't need to be the giant Ford F-150, whatever they're called.
hold on. I just find this fascinating because it's like, we're not trying to degrow just for the hell of it, right? We're just like, you know what? We want to make everyone miserable. We don't want you to have a big truck. We hate the fact that you drive this big truck around with balls hanging out, that the balls on the back.
That's like three trucks. That
we
you don't
fucking we
you
just we hate you. So we want you to drive like a smart car around everywhere. Like it's the reason this is being suggested is because there's actual planetary limits, right? There's a very important reason we're undermining the entire basis of life itself on this planet. And so I think it has to always be viewed in that context. It's like, well, who gets to say this? It's like, bro, you don't actually have a choice. Like, we have to do this,
I don't
right?
think that you can frame the argument of existential risk to the planet coming down to Ford F-350 and truck nuts. I think there are other things out there that are sucking up way more resources and contributing way more pollution than a Ford F-350. And I don't know why I'm dying on this hill of the fucking
truck. No, and I don't want us to get sidetracked into the trucks. Really, the truck is a
metaphor, JP. Yeah.
It really is the industries that are designed to create things that are ecologically harmful and socially not very necessary. Let's say industries that have an outsized impact on our ecology than others. Like I mentioned, like industrial meat, for example, that's undeniable, right? That it has a huge impact on our ecology, on our ecosystems, on our climate, etc. Or fossil fuels, for example. But really, the push, I'm really talking about private jets, giant mansions, cruises, yachts, the weapons industry, right, etc. And at the same time, you know, if we want to flip the narrative on it, or frame it in this way, like, you know, this whole idea that we're all for freedom and liberty, etc., yet we're denying millions, if not billions, of people the freedom of liberty to live a dignified life with access to electricity, access to education, access to healthcare, etc., because some people are using way too much resources, or this imperialist, colonialist dynamic is just denying many of these nations access to the resources they need for adequate and accessible and universal healthcare, education, public transit, etc. So if we're all about, you know, freedom and liberty for everybody, for every human, to live a dignified life, right, to have the opportunity to work hard and make something of themselves if they want to, then our priority should also be about ensuring that these people have the material means and have the energy necessary to live these dignified and lives.
JP, I don't even know if just in the context of the United States, I don't know if our policymakers are even concerned with providing basic dignity to our own population,
Absolutely.
Let alone globally. But that's where we start running. Okay, fine. Okay. Again, in spirit, I agree with everything you're saying. I'm trying to think of it in like a pragmatic, like live fire deployment situation, right? Let's say we do somehow in the next 4-8 years elect in an administration and a supporting legislative body that is more focused on, fuck it, like bare minimum, providing adequate food accessibility to the population. Let's just take that one policy issue, right? To feed the population of the United States that's currently living in food deserts, that is malnourished, doesn't have access to quality produce, that's going to take resources. Mm-hmm. It's going to take a level of coexistence with the productive output of the capitalist system, because that's how our economic model is structured. No, even if you have the most Bernie Sanders, Jesus Christ-esque figure in office in the United States, no politician would voluntarily cap the growth potential of their country in order to benefit the planet, because they will first and foremost need to be putting the interests of their own population at heart, and that will require growth. How do we reconcile national interest, care for our immediate neighbors, versus the demands and problems of the global community?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it, because yes, and that's one of the trickiest parts that's not really figured out. And look, I want to make it clear, I don't know everything, right? I'm also figuring out life as we go along, and these are some really complex topics and ideas that we're dealing with. But it is true, right? One country degrows, like, that's capital flight all the way, right?
Yeah, you know? That's right.
At the end of the day, they're at a disadvantage to their neighbors, right? And all the other countries that aren't necessarily degrowing. So there's absolutely zero incentive.
And by the way, this is a problem that every single revolutionary in the 20th century faced. Like, everybody who ever tried to like step up against the neoliberal global order, you know, be it Cuba, Vietnam, whatever, that at some point you face that issue where you are still one country amid a global system of nations, each struggling for their own self-interest, and borders are still porous. So beyond, you know, going full North Korea and closing off your borders to any movement of capital or people, it's going to be very difficult to address this sort of situation without some sort of global movement at play.
Yeah. And so what's interesting is that now, like, let's say we get, like, following your scenario, that there are policies that we could implement that could quite quickly increase and improve people's material condition and slow down the logic of capitalism. So, for example, if we were to introduce a federally funded and locally administered federal jobs guarantee, and this means that if you want a job, the government will give you a job. And if we make sure that this is federally funded, for example, and locally administered in saying that the importance is economic democracy, right? Ensuring that the people working there have decisions over what is being produced or and where it's going to and how it's being produced, etc. What the federal government can mandate, for example, is the types of jobs that will happen, right? And we can make sure that these are into education, into healthcare, into creating renewables, public transit, in restoring mangroves in the Everglades, into reforesting large swaths of land, into agro.
So command economy. And I'm not trying to be like controversial, but that's
not necessarily a command economy. It's saying it's not saying that the private sector can't exist. It's saying that the government is taking its responsibility to ensure the well-being of its people and ensure that the will of the people is being respected, right? So it's providing these jobs if they want it. And so what happens if you're unemployed or you're not happy with your job? And the important part is that they would be paying dignified wages, right? Not living wages, dignified wages. So you get a job with the government. It's locally administered. Remember, the big feds, they aren't telling you what to do. It's locally administered, federally funded. There's economic democracy. You have a say in this corporation or this cooperative or whatever. What are you going to choose, right? Working on something meaningful and pleasant, having a dignified wage, stability, etc., or making guidance systems for Lockheed Martin, or flipping burgers at Burger King, or right, delivering packages for Amazon, etc. What happens is that these private industries will have to compete now with the government. And this competition means that they would have to increase their wages or improve their working conditions or improve the meaningfulness of these jobs in order to still attract employees, right? Because now they're facing a very serious competitor with very deep pockets and essentially the law on its side. So that's one example of a fairly simple policy that could be implemented nationwide that could limit the power of capital and could also, like this, move process and productive capacity to the socially and ecologically necessary things that we need to do. Because Levon, you mentioned earlier that we could innovate in 200, 500 years. We don't need to. 100% essentially of all of the solutions that we need to solve our current ecological and social crises exist. They exist today in this world. They're just not profitable, or they're not profitable enough. And that's why they're not funded by capitalism, because capitalism needs profit. And so how can we depend on an economic and political system that cannot logically prioritize human and ecological well-being, because it can only prioritize profits, right? These solutions exist. Solar is cheaper than any existing fossil fuel in the world, anywhere, right? But that means profitable, right? It's not as profitable as it is to keep selling and pumping oil or gas, etc. And they have more control over that because solar is more decentralized as well. And then,
you're not 100% wrong about that. Yeah, but like,
and just a quick other point on another very impactful and fairly simple policy that again can limit the power of capital is. Personally, I'd say nationalize the banks, but that's never going to happen in the United States. But what could happen is for the central bank to create credit guidance systems that very, very strongly incentivize banks to lend to green, ecological, renewables, etc. Industries, and limit their ability or at the end ban them from redirecting investments to harmful industries like fast fashion, like fossil fuels, like the arms industry, like SUVs, like private jets, etc. This is something that the central bank can do, refuses to do, and can have we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars of investments flowing one way because it's profitable and being forced to flow the other way because it's what's socially and ecologically necessary. And the central bank has the power of creating credit guidance systems to force banks essentially to redirect the money towards probably less profitable, but much more socially and ecologically necessary production.
Why advocate for the public sector to kind of almost manually dictate some of these things, as opposed to, can the government apply the right incentive structures within within the existing capitalistic framework? For example, you know, you're talking about like carbon taxes, et cetera, to steer the free market or the somewhat regulated market to actually allocate the resources more efficiently. Cause I think that's what it could do if we could find a way to properly value things, right? Like, so we don't know how to value like a gallon of gasoline. It's like, well, should it be, you know, $3 a gallon? Like, I mean, if you factor in the ecological impact or the impact on your health from breathing in, you know, that pollutant, like if it was $10 a gallon, like would that automatically already incentivize, you know, more investment towards solar?
I mean, what's happening in California? Like, I think that's a good example of that, right? Because they tax the shit out of their gasoline prices. You try to fill up your car, it's like bare minimum, like $6 a gallon. But I mean, yeah. Sorry, JP, go ahead.
No stress. One thing to note, increasing fuel prices is probably the easiest and most verifiable way to get everybody pissed off. Don't do it. Don't do it. Provide alternative means so that people don't have to depend on combustion vehicles. Don't increase fuel prices. Just a tiny little asterisk there, because you'll piss everyone off, and it happens all of the time.
Well, without a proper alternative, yes, absolutely.
So the thing is, like, again, we're going back to the fundamental logics of capitalism, right? That it depends on profit making. It depends on creating surplus value, and to make surplus value, it needs to be profitable. How can we depend on a system that will do absolutely everything in its power to ensure profits are, and when I mean everything, capitalists profit from genocide. They profit from war. They murder, they military invade, they assassinate, they create coups around the world if you look at history, and you said this as well, Andre, absolutely any form of resistance to the capitalist world order dominated by the United States and its Western vassal states, has been systematically destroyed, whether it's the Black Panther Party domestically, whether it's Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, whether it's Patrice Lumumba in the Congo, whether it's communist Vietnam, whether it's communist China, whether it's the Soviet Union, whether it's...
Just to be fair, this isn't anything unique to a capitalist system. I think we do have to also acknowledge that any other human systems that have existed have also wiped out their enemies. It's nothing unique to being a capitalist that you want your immediate threat parameters to be eliminated.
Sure, but absolutely never to this scale. Never in human history have we seen destruction, tyranny, and global authoritativeness at this level than with US-led Western capitalist imperialism. There's never been as many cumulative...
Do you think it's... Okay, we're getting into semantics, and I'm sorry, but do you think it's worse than what the British Empire inflicted on its colonial base, or even the Spanish Empire?
Do I think it's worse? I think it's very much comparable. I think many could make the argument that yes, the US-led empire is the worst empire in terms of tyranny and in terms of harm done to the world and people than any other empire in history. In my opinion, and in others' opinion, but I don't want us to get down this track of empire, etc. I was just pointing this out as an example of capitalism's power to circumvent absolutely any moral or legal obligation to get what it wants. And so, with any kind of regulation, and we've seen this throughout history, right? They will go above and beyond to find the loophole, to lawyer up, to sue the government, to buy the politician, to get enough votes, etc., to either reverse that regulation or limit its impact or give it an exemption, etc. And I think that, as you mentioned, we live in a time that's dire, right? We're in an emergency. It's a crisis that we're facing. So how can we depend on a system that's logic does not allow it to solve this problem? First of all, and definitely not anywhere near fast enough than what we need to do. And a federal public jobs guarantee or a credit guidance system isn't like, you know, full-blown communism or anything like that. We're not nationalizing the banks. We're not nationalizing industries. You know, we're not sending the National Guard to cities to make sure that people do what we say, et cetera. What we're saying is that we are heavily incentivizing banks to invest in things that are socially and ecologically necessary, and we're providing one, we're solving unemployment. That's which is key, because not only has capitalism absolutely underdeveloped and deprived the global majority from the resources necessary for a dignified life, it has also deprived and systematically oppressed its own domestic working class population, right?
You're not wrong about that. Yeah.
And any so-called eco-socialist or degrowth or et cetera must prioritize the material conditions of the people in that nation, right? And so providing a living wage and a federal job guarantee can dramatically increase the economic democracy that is inexistent in capitalism. There is no democracy when it comes to the economy. You vote once every 4 years, maybe every two, and whoopee, that's it. You know, that's your democracy. But when it comes to the workplace, do you get to decide what gets produced, how it gets produced, for whom, how much gets produced, etc.? That's inexistent. There is no democracy in the economy in the United States. It is the people with money and wealth and the corporations that decide what, how, when, for whom, etc. And so if we were able to increase economic democracy with this federal jobs guarantee program, for example, provide these living wages, dramatically improve people's material conditions, solve unemployment. I mean, literally, that's all that Republicans and Democrats like complain about in terms of the population, not the parties, right? And so you would absolutely get the backing of the vast majority of the population, because they can see the impact. They can feel it. They can see their material conditions improving. And then I think would be much more amenable towards a more radical global sense of like reparations, right? Or systematic capping of resource use or emissions that slowly goes down over time once their material conditions are met. But if their material conditions are not met, they don't care. Nobody cares about the ecology. Nobody cares about the environment. And that's fair. I don't blame them, because they're worried about putting food on the table. They're worried about paying rent. They're worried about their sick mom, or, you know.
Yeah, but once they have that, I mean, once people have that, you know, then they just compare themselves to their neighbor, and then they're like, well, you know, I want to do better than my neighbor, right? Like, people, they're not necessarily satisfied once they reach a certain point. Then they look at the next thing. And so it's not clear to me that kind of the theory, almost the theory of human nature that is presented, you know, in the degrowth model or assumed in the degrowth model, it doesn't seem wholly consistent with my understanding of human nature. I think people always do want more.
Wanting more collapsed the Soviet Union, essentially, right? You had jobs, you had healthcare, you had education, but the system still imploded because they saw other countries with Levi's blue jean denim, right? Like,
And it goes back to the, you know, if you degrow, then you might be outcompeted by people that aren't degrowing, and they have no limits to, you know, whatever they're doing. But also, I think, you know, it's interesting to think about this from like a global kind of game theory standpoint. One of the, I would say, the positives of growth has been that you change the game theory dynamics to a positive sum game. Right? Because if it's a zero-sum game, then if I have something, then you naturally have less of a thing that you could have. So once you change it to a positive-sum game, all of a sudden cooperation is a lot easier. And someone could make the case that, well, we are living in, you know, the most, relatively speaking, like the most peaceful time since, I don't know, maybe even before the agricultural revolution. I mean, granted, we've had some world wars, we still have some wars, and that peace is obtained through exploiting the global South in unimaginable ways. So maybe I'm undoing what I'm saying here as I speak it. But I mean, what would you say about that? I mean, like, I do think there's something true about, you know, if the pie is growing, everyone's still kind of satisfied, right? And I mean, you kind of made that point earlier as you were talking about growth. So when you cap growth, I mean, again, you've changed the game theory, like a very fundamental game theory dynamic. Would that not lead to less cooperation, less trade, more war, even though we already have some of that, you know, for growth reasons as well? Where the reasons for the reasons to cooperate, God, I'm getting lost here.
I'm happy to jump in.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say, you know, like when you change that game theory dynamic from non-zero sum to zero sum, yes, you still have some incentives for profit and growth, and that leads to some amount of war, et cetera. But when you go from a non-zero sum to a zero sum game, the desire for war and all that to get the resources that are limited now outweighs all the damage that would have been done otherwise. I don't know.
I'm actually quite glad you brought this up, because I don't think this gets talked about enough, because I actually think it's a bit of the opposite. Don't want to be devil's advocate here, but for example, we can say that the United States is one of the most like capitalist driven countries, right, in recent memory. It is the only country with over 900 military bases on this planet. Right.
Valid. Yeah.
It is the country that has almost single-handedly, of course, with the support of their Basel states in NATO, absolutely destroyed Libya, Afghanistan, Iraq, attacked Somalia, Iran, now is planning on trying to invade Nigeria, has allowed...
Forget Venezuela. We're going to invade Venezuela too.
Was just getting there, right? But why, right? And if it was zero sum, right, or if it was all positive sum, etc., right, they wouldn't need to be stealing resources from these countries, right? That's the reason of the war in the Middle East, because they wanted the oil. The reason they want to attack Venezuela is because, one, they're producing a threat towards the global capitalist system. Two, because they have the largest reserves of oil in the world, right? Nigeria has a huge reserve of oil as well.
JP, the point though there is, the fact that they're still doing this under a positive sum game theory dynamic just underscores the fact that it would be so much worse if you take that positive sum dynamic out.
So I don't necessarily disagree, but what I'm saying is that it's not, they don't view it as positive sum. They view it as zero sum. That's why they have to go into other countries and steal their resources, because they know that they need it and they will need to deprive others from it. They know that they need to take Venezuela's oil. They needed to take Iran's and Iraq's oil. They needed to take Afghanistan's resources and gold, etc. They can't necessarily do that to China, for example. But you look at the rhetoric. You literally just read speeches from their foreign ministers, from officials, from presidents, etc. Right? The United States just publicly announces how we have to limit China. It cannot be our peer. It cannot reach our level. We have to make sure that it remains, you know, manageable, etc. Whereas you read the rhetoric from the foreign ministers of China, and you read, you know, the need for global cooperation, for collaboration, for respect, for dignity between these nations, that there is enough space in this world for all of us to work together and achieve mutually desired outcomes, etc. And so,
well, I mean, it is also an official statement from the government apparatus of a nation. Like, I mean, I think everything should be taken with a grain of salt, just like freedom, justice, equality for all. Like, it's a form of propaganda that's being exercised. Let's not be ignorant.
Definitely.
But although it's hard to say that China wouldn't be more open to cooperation at a global scale than the U.S. in some ways. I mean, at least given the current administration, like I wouldn't say that was necessarily true, but yeah.
I honestly don't think it matters on the administration, right? Both Republicans and Democrats are warmongers. Most of them deserve
two
to be
parties, one jacket. Yeah, yeah.
And how many wars has China started in the last 50 years, right? How many wars has the United States started in the last 50 years, et cetera?
Yeah, but they use coal power plants, bro. they're, you know, right? They're sinners. Yeah.
Oh, I missed that.
Well, they have other problems, though. I mean, it's, yeah, let's not even, there's no reason to compare. I mean, everyone's kind of fucked up. But yeah, the U.S. certainly, well, I just can't help myself, I guess.
So, no,
we can't help ourselves.
Yeah. So essentially, I mean, the United States very much sees this as zero sum. They go in, military invade, steal resources, and get away with it because they control the international rules-based order. For example, what we're proposing as a more eco-socialist, anti-imperialist, degrowth scenario, but let's focus on degrowth, the pie doesn't necessarily need to... The pie as we see it doesn't necessarily need to shrink, right? We might be shrinking in terms of money or wealth, for example, or in terms of how much gets produced. But what if the pie wasn't measured in terms of how much crap gets produced and how much wealth there is? What if the pie was about how happy people were? What if the pie was about if their needs were met and if they had community, if they were friends with their neighbors, if their mental health was good, if they were... how much they danced or how much art was produced per capita, for example, etc. No, I'm starting to get a little hippy dippy, but what I'm really serious about is if people's, you know, material conditions are met. And what if that was the pie instead of global wealth, etc.? So I don't really see that as a zero sum, because well-being, to me, it seems pretty limitless in how much we can do to improve people's happiness, right? If that was the overall objective, or the restoration of ecology. Right. And so,
yeah, sure. I think there's a cultural issue here where, you know, people don't understand actually what seems to make them happy, more or less. Right. I mean, it's just like the idea that you need to consume and, you know, you need some material, like some exorbitant material wealth to be happy is honestly capitalistic propaganda.
I mean, if your wealth is attached to receiving stable food and healthcare, you can maintain.
Well, yes, I mean, beyond those things. But I do think selling degrowth as not a sacrifice, but an improvement to quality of life. Like, it's like the, you know, the movement for minimalism. It's like, you know, you use less stuff, but you have less mental clutter. You can focus on the things that actually matter and not be dragged down by stuff. I mean, it's really like... If it can be sold in that way, I think that's a lot more appealing, because the moment it's viewed as a sacrifice, like, oh, I have to give up my truck. It's like, no. It's not about your truck. You're going to gain this.
Uh-huh.
And then, you know, then you sneak in the fact that, yeah, you might lose your truck, but like, you're going to gain
the proverbial F-350. But JP, to that point, to what you were talking about, what Levon's talking about, what thoughts do you have on like building this sort of movement from like the individual level? Like, right, what does the average citizen of, in our context, the US, somebody in Europe, but how do you like the ideas and idealism and ambition is there. We can agree, maybe not on everything, but across the board on fairly select items that like everybody wants to have their bare needs met. They want to have stable housing, health, all of that. All of us face around the world to a certain extent, at times insurmountable political odds, right? So is this a question of seizing political power? Is it a question of working in like micro communities? What is your prescription or your thoughts? Maybe it's unfair to ask you to draw up a policy document right now, but your thoughts on getting this kind of movement started in like a pragmatic sense.
Yeah, no, fully. I think that's a fundamental question. What do I do? Right? I'm listening to this podcast. You, my dear listener, listening to my voice. What are you supposed to do?
Our 10 listeners. Yeah. Yes.
I mean, before, and a lot of what you hear from the climate, environmental movement, etc., or at least used to, a lot of it was on your individual actions, right? Like consume less energy, you know, take shorter showers, erase your old emails, etc., right? which is a joke. It's a literal joke. I mean, unless you're planning on having less kids or planning on becoming vegan, like, or just stopping flying, like, irrelevant, really. In the short term, you know, understanding global scale of the crisis, etc., right? What I would tell people that is most fundamentally necessary is democracy, right? And that's a huge thing that degrowth is pushing for. We, as I've explained before, we don't exist. There is no democracy in the Western liberal system. There is no democracy. You get to vote for some guy every 4 years, but they're the same. I mean, ish. I know that recently things are a bit intense, and a lot of people are suffering more than in the last administration, and I don't want to deny the validity of that. But in terms of a global capitalist imperialist order, it really is the same for the global majority. And so what we need to do is organize around democracy, organize around workplace democracy. It does not exist. And we need people to move towards organizing towards a mass-based political party that is responsive to the genuine needs of the people and is democratic. The Democratic Party and the Republican Party are not democratic. The amount of insider play-in and donors and machinations and influence of corporations is, I mean, this is a fact. Everybody knows this. Listen to Sheldon Whitehouse and you can get a clearer picture all the way up to the Supreme Court. But if people were to start organizing their communities, raising awareness about these issues, raising awareness about the true cause of these issues, that their material deprivation primarily comes because, one, it's not profitable for the capitalists, or wealth is being hoarded, right? And because economic democracy doesn't exist. So if people were to start organizing around these issues and genuinely start demanding that their material needs be met, not only their basic needs, their dignified needs be met, I think that we could see the beginning of a potential mass-based political party in the United States, not beholden to corporate interests, that is truly of the people, and works for the people. It's not easy. Don't get me wrong. It's much easier spoken than said. But that I see is the only, really, as the only potential, playbook for the world, the entire world.
The degrowth movement, you would say, is still a systemic movement versus a revolutionary movement. You're not trying to usurp the conditions of power. You're trying to maintain or play within the rules as they're written. Maybe that the rules that aren't being abided by everybody, but this is still, we're not advocating for global revolution. We're advocating for systemic change.
Depends who you ask. I have different answers for different audiences.
I'm almost offended that we're not the audience that gets the revolutionary treatment. Like that's.
You got to be careful, right? And I don't speak for the movement. The existence of a degrowth movement is also like debated, and it's very, not everybody agrees. Some are eco-socialists, some are more eco-anarchists. Depends. Some are pro-armed liberation movements, some are more reformist. It depends, right? I think what would the most pragmatic pathway for the United States or the global North is to seize state power, but through mass-based organizing of a political party. And if that doesn't work, then a coup. Because we're running out of time, and we genuinely need to redirect massive amounts of productive capacity that is impossible to do without a state authority at this moment, in my opinion. Many would say that this, you know, will then continue to perpetuate these state capitalist authoritative dynamics, etc. But my personal opinion is that we need to seize government power with a party that works genuinely for the people and isn't beholden to corporate interests, that can actually deliver these material gains necessary for the vast majority of the population, so that then we can start talking about reparations, about land back, about caps, and about ecological sufficiency.
Yeah, but you know, we run into the problem that was mentioned earlier, though. You know, let's say you do that here in the States or, you know, any other country. I mean, globally, again, you're potentially outcompeted, you're ignored, capital flight, etc. I mean, again, like without a global government without something more substantive than the UN, for example, with more authority and efficacy. Like, it just seems like the game theory math, like, doesn't work out there.
I don't necessarily disagree. Maybe I need to be a little more hopeful for my mental health, to be honest, since this is all that I do. But I wasn't going to bring this up, but since you mentioned this, like, if this doesn't work, then the absolutely highest priority for anybody should be to support sovereignty in the global south and support delinking movements in the global south. And by delinking, I don't mean autarky. I don't mean, like you mentioned earlier, Andre, North Korea, closing yourself out. But essentially, it's about subordinating external relations to domestic priorities, right? So we're talking about food, energy, industrial, economic, monetary sovereignty, right? We're talking about production directed towards national development objectives, not what the IMF and the World Bank are dictating these countries to do, right? Using public ownership, regional finance, south-south trade, internationalism, debt swaps, etc., collectively defaulting on debt owed to the global north as a global south, and really emphasizing and pushing for this internationalist sovereignty or delinking movement, where we are delinking the north from the south. And I think this could have dramatic consequences. Again, we remember that 25% of global north GDP depends on this unequal exchange of extraction from the south. If that were to stop in a coordinated manner, right, within the global south to absorb the shock of their export dependent industries, right, needing to build out their industrial capacity first in order to ensure that their population can get what they need. Because right now, unfortunately, we depend a lot on the IP, particularly in tech and medicine, of the global north that they're very greedy about and unwilling to share and charge exuberant prices just so people can afford medicine and have decent access to technology. So if your mass-based politics organizing fails, absolutely do your very best to support delinking and sovereignty movements in the global south, because I see it as one of the only ways, essentially forcing the global north to degrow by reducing access to resources.
But, you know, I just feel like that creates, so it creates less of a dependence, right? Like, you know, each nation, or even if you want to break it down to the global north and south, they become more resilient within themselves. However, I think the linking and the interdependence between nations actually, although it's asymmetrical in terms of, you know, cost benefit, you certainly argue, it does provide some sort of stability, some sort of, at least, well, I mean, I say that.
It prevents us from going down the same path as we did 100 years ago, where you had multiple military alliances, multiple competing military interests. The chances of us going to war with China, which would be a global catastrophe, are far lower because there are still economic ties between the United States and China that both sides tend to value more than outright conflict.
Very much true. But there's only one China, right? There is no other country in the world that can stand
up. Actually, technically, there are two Chinas, but, you know.
I don't think I agree, because we're not living in a peaceful time. The United States is actively funding a genocide. The European Union is actively
100%.
Funding a genocide, right?
100%.
Right? Indirectly by selling arms to the UAE, who's bringing them to the RSF in Sudan, for example, not just in Palestine. So this world order is not working. It's violent, it's tyrannical, it's authoritative, and it's undemocratic.
But to Levon's point, it is not as violent and tyrannical as it was 100 years ago, because yes, these things are happening, but the rate at which people were being like vaporized off the face of the earth was far more severe in the scope of what was going on in the 20th century.
What if it takes another event like that to get to the point of a more ecologically sustainable, you know, equitable kind of global society? What if we need another just absolutely horrific event? where there's potentially hundreds of millions or billions of people dying. I'm not advocating for it, obviously. Nobody clipped this, please.
I don't know why.
But like, no, but it might be the case that there really is. I mean, we keep talking about this and that, like, and anything JP says, it's easy to play devil's advocate, right? Like, I can say, oh, well, that changes the game theory dynamics to this. And, oh, if you do that, then, well, of course, like, everything has kind of like
a consequence. A cost
benefit. Everything has different implications. What if there is no actual solution here other than just a total kind of reset?
I want to be clear about what I'm arguing with delinking, because it is a much more coordinated and collaborative world system that we're envisioning, where no one power gets authority and hegemonic power over any other. It really is about South-South collaboration, internationalism, solidarity, pushing for the breaking of these chains of imperialism, right? Of these transnational corporations that own entire supply chains of these nations that that invade other countries whenever there's any resistance to this world order, etc. It's making that finally not okay to do, because now it is okay to do. It's fine. There's no repercussions for Israel. There's no repercussions for Europe. There's no repercussions for the United States for all of the war crimes that they've done. And it's creating a system that recognizes these imperial power dynamics and will use force if necessary to assert their sovereignty, their right to a sovereign national development. And so at the moment, I see this as a lot more right now is a key opportunity to do this because of the rise of China, because China has now provided the global South with an alternative. China might not necessarily be the best, but it's an alternative that they never had. Before, it was only the IMF, the World Bank, or the gringos. And now we're at a space where we have an alternative. And with rising economic powers as well, whether it's Iran, South Africa, Russia, Brazil, or Mexico, etc., and several countries pushing progressive governments, where it is a prime moment to take this genuinely seriously and start building out your productive capacity via green industrial policy to ensure that you can produce what you need within your national boundaries to achieve your national development objectives. And I don't necessarily see this as autarky. Again, it depends on trade and collaboration. You know, one country can't produce anything. There's no country in the world that can produce everything it needs. The closest is China. And the one thing they can't produce is extreme ultraviolet lithography machines to make chips. That's the one thing that they essentially cannot produce. And that's as close as it gets, right? So trade is necessary, and that necessitates stability, right? Necessitates cooperation and necessitates collaboration. But it's really pushing to a worldview where we see each other as equals, partners, and are willing to cooperate in a dignified way, because the current world order is not dignified. It's denigrating. It is unjust. And it's one big bully telling everyone else what to do, whether it's Biden or Trump or Bush. It's at the end of the day, for the world global majority, it's been the same. It's the corporations, right, and the capitalists that get to decide. And so I do see this as a more stable system. Potentially in the future, in the near term, it might become more violent because, you know, a dog is most scared when it's trapped, or most dangerous when it's trapped in a corner, right? Which is increasingly what the United States is seeing. But if this movement or is able to get the backing of China or other armed nuclear powers as a deterrence, then I think it's quite possible that that it doesn't have to be a violent revolutionary movement, but a controlled and planned transition towards a more equal and just world that values sovereignty as much as it values democracy. But hey, who am I?
I think that I think that's a good note to end on. I mean, I think it's hard to disagree with a lot of what you just said there. And I think hopefully people listening can take something away from this. And, you know, to whatever extent an individual can contribute positively toward these things, I mean, I think this is having conversations like this is at least a first step. So we, of course, very much appreciate you coming on. If people want to find more of your work, where can they go?
Yeah, thanks. And thank you both for the opportunity. This has actually been a lot of fun. Nice to practice my English after being in Mexico for so long. So
we practice our English too, and we live in an English speaking country. So it's,
no, but it's also good food for the brain to think about these things. If people wanted to find a little bit more about the kind of work that we do or want to read up a little bit more about some of the topics that I mentioned, there are two websites that I would very much recommend. If you're interested about a bit of more of this delinking, imperialism, colonialism, or inequality dynamics, I could recommend you go to the globalinequality.org website. So that's just globalinequality.org. And if you're interested in learning more about degrowth and what it entails, because I could have spoken about it for hours, and all the different policies that we missed out on, you could go to explore.degrowth.net. And that's a website that I actually made for my thesis a couple years back, for my master's, that tries to, it's an educational resource about degrowth. Yeah.
And also Jason Hickel's, Less is More book, that's actually how I got in touch with JP originally, is having read that book and reaching out to Jason. A really fantastic summary, a fantastic takedown of capitalism. Mm-hmm. Brutal. I mean, it was just savage what he did to capitalism. Yeah. But yeah, I highly recommend people read that book and check that out as well. But yeah, we'll put all those links in the show notes.
Yeah, and that that Global Inequality Project was something that I, one of the first projects I worked with Jason on. So it's very rigorous. It's very well sourced. And so if you like the book, Less is More, you're going to love this globalinequality.org website. It's great.
All right. Thank you again.
Thank
JP.
You, JP.
We'll catch you. Yeah, we'll catch you. I'm sure we'll have you on again at some point. This was fantastic.
We'll get you on when the next big global event happens.
Sure. I love geopolitics, so feel free.
What to do now that we've degrown?
I think Andres offered every guest, like, hey, you'll come back on, when the next global big event happens. But it was like, we'll have a round table of, like, 100 people.
Maybe, like, a live stream of, like, of the asteroid hitting Earth. We'll, like, just bring on all.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much, man.
Thanks, JP.
We appreciate you.
Ciao.